is the official beginning of the monthly meeting of the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. The date is February 22nd, and it's about 10 o'clock in the morning, California time. I am an attorney. I am also executive director of the organization. And with me is Axol board member Jeff Stein, who's a criminal defense attorney. By the way, I'm a civil attorney. And so Jeff and I complement each other really well. We have a little bit of overlap in our practices, but mostly he knows the criminal law and I know civil law. So again, we complement each other quite well. So there are some announcements I certainly want to make here at the very beginning of the meeting. I hope you all know about the events, but just in case you don't, here goes. I am going to be in Washington, D.C. Next week. In fact, a week from yesterday, on the last day of February, I will be traveling to Washington, D.C. because we have we being several different organizations, this is not Axol, will be gathering in Washington, D.C. for a one-day conference on Sunday, March 1st. Sorry, Sunday, March 2nd. So the conference is all day long and it's near Washington, D.C. It's not in Washington, D.C. It's actually at a Holiday Inn near Reagan National Airport. And we have conference space there that we have rented the meeting room. At this point in time, we have a little bit over 70 people who've signed up for the conference. There's room for more. So if you are so inclined, and I hope you are, please join us in Washington, D.C. So they will in Washington, D.C. That will be followed by our third annual vigil near the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court the following day, Monday, March 3rd. And this is something that's extremely important, I think, to it is for me personally, and I think it should be for the movement as well, because guess what? There's one decision from the U.S. Supreme Court that has harmed so many people and continues to harm many more people that need to be overturned. So we go back to the court and we're doing it on an annual basis now just to remind them that they made a big mistake and it's time for them to do a correct mistake by overturning Smith versus Doe. So if you have interest in either one of those, there's a whole lot more details about them on the Axol website. And again, I hope that you'll be able to join us again in Washington, D.C. So somebody asked, I will be present, but will the D.C. vigil be streamed? Yes, it will. There will be a live stream of the vigil on Monday, March 3rd. It also will be recorded so you can watch later. The time of the vigil is 11 a.m. and that's Eastern time, so 8 a.m. California time. We'll have at least an hour worth of speakers during the vigil. We'll have people holding up signs. We have a lot of rules to follow, so we can't get too loud and we cannot be boisterous. And the signs have to be limited to a certain size and all that other stuff. Materials, it's okay. They have their rules published, and so we're doing our best to follow them. But again, it's really important for us to let the Supreme Court know that they made a terrible, terrible mistake, right? I mean, and if they don't know it, it's kind of sad that they wouldn't know it, but it's possible that they didn't know it because I'll just tell you one thing. Okay, so during oral argument in the case Smith versus Doe, the attorney John Roberts, who is now the Chief Justice John Roberts, is the same person. So during oral argument, he said that being on the registry was not punishment, and he said that registration itself was similar to applying for membership in Price Club. Think about it. Price Club? Are you kidding me? And by the way, in case you don't have Price Club in your state, maybe you have Costco, maybe you have Sam's Club, but you know what I'm talking about, the big box stores. And I mean, you know, an elementary school student would know that that's not true because you know why? You can always cancel your membership in Price Club, right? You just say, oh, I don't want to be a member anymore, and you stop paying your dues. Unfortunately, you know, if you're on the registry, you don't have that option most of the time. So anyway, again, we need to educate the court. So the second announcement I want to make is, in fact, about our annual lobby day in Sacramento. So we will be returning to the state legislature in Sacramento on March 25. And so I hope that you all will join us. You don't have to be from California to join us. We welcome you, even if you're from another state. And what we're talking about with the state legislators, staff, we're talking about the tiered registry law. So the tiered registry law has made a huge difference in California. I believe there's been more than 8,000 people who have been relieved of the duty to register because of the tiered registry law, but it's not nearly enough. I believe that more than 40,000 people are eligible to petition for removal, and for a variety of reasons, they haven't done so yet. So anyway, we're going to ask them to make some changes to the tiered registry law that would make a heck of a lot more people eligible to petition for removal from the registry. So, I mean, think about this, folks. California, if you were convicted of possessing child pornography and it was a felony, you're going to be assigned to the highest tier. or tier three. And that means you're going to have to register for life. There's no way that you petition for removal. And that makes no sense. Rapists, okay, maybe an argument could be made that those people need to be monitored for life. Maybe. I'm not in complete agreement there. I hope you recognize. But the fact is that somebody who is possessed child pornography certainly doesn't belong on the darn register for life. So that's where we are right now. And again, March 25th is the date, and we will be here in Sacramento. We'll start at the Hyatt Hotel, which is close to the Capitol and the office buildings. And then we will walk in the training in the morning, and then in the afternoon, we'll go to pre-arranged meeting. And by the way, nobody goes to these meetings alone. Okay, we wouldn't do that. We wouldn't throw you in there with a lion. This isn't the, we're not asking you to be a gladiator at all. We're asking you to join a team. By the way, the team will be led by Jeff Stein or myself, somebody else who has experience in this lobbying process. And then, we can help guide you through the process. So anyway, remember those two dates if you would. March 3rd is the vigil in Washington, D.C., near the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court. And March 25 is the lobby day here in Sacramento. So there's a question from John. Are there ever protesters against the group? I assume you're talking about the D.C. vigil, and the answer is no, absolutely not. It's been interest. It's been, I mean, we didn't even know the first year, and there were a lot of people who were nervous, the first year in particular, that there might be some people there, like people who had an opposing view, shall we say, might be there, and they might be there near us, shouting at us, or somebody throwing something at us, or heaven forbid, somebody get violent. None of that has ever happened. Okay, so I've been there 2 years, and for 2 years, nothing's happened. It's except for the fact that people who are curious come up to us and ask why we're there and what is this all about. I even had I've had the media come up and ask questions. Well, so far the media hasn't covered our protest. I actually call it a vigil. But I'm waiting for that day to happen. So please, please, March 33rd, right? It's and that's not meetings on the Hill, folks. March 3rd is meeting. No, this is March 3rd is our vigil at the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court. There are barriers there, by the way. The barriers are not there for us. The barriers are there just barriers these days. I mean, it's really sad for me to see. I worked downtown Washington, D.C. for many years, and there never used to be these barriers. But, it was really, it started on January 5th, or maybe it was, I should say, January 6th, right? The barriers went up. So anyway, please join us. Capitol Police are all around. That's right. Watching for protection and barriers. They are. They're here, though, to protect us. So I'm not the least bit concerned about the police. By the way, we sent in the formal notification that's required. And in addition to that, I'll just say we sent a letter to the U.S. Supreme Court just. This is the first time we've done that. So we thought, you know what? Let's just go ahead, even, if they're not aware of what we're doing in real time or even reports from whoever later, let's let them know we're coming. So we sent them a letter that said we're coming. And when I say we, there are 43 different organizations who signed the letter. 43. That's just really amazing. We've never had this much cooperation in our community before. So that's fabulous. John is asking, what should we not bring to the Hill? Well, for one thing, don't show up at the Hill because we won't be there. We'll be at the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court, which is across the street, folks. Please don't go to the Capitol. And don't bring weapons. Don't bring any. Just please use your common sense. It's like going to the airport. Okay. Don't take anything with you that you wouldn't have at the airport. Is that a clear enough answer? If you can bring a water bottle, you can bring, things like that. Don't bring knives, guns, nunchucks, anything like that. Folks, come on. This is a peaceful protest, right? And the worst thing that could happen is you might get cold. So if you do come, please, please, please dress appropriately. I'm following the weather in Washington, D.C. As of today, the high that day is supposed to be 47 degrees. For some of you, that thing seems balmy, right? For some of us, go, it's going to be a little cool. So I'm planning to dress in about four layers myself. Okay. Does the U.S. Supreme Court have the option to just suddenly decide to change the decision without a lawsuit being filed? No. So that's a good question. In order to overturn Smith v. Doe, they're first going to have to grant review. That is the legal term, grant review of a case that's coming up through the other courts. We have a case that might end up there, and I'll talk about it in a little while. It's the case in which Axall is a plaintiff, and the litigating organization is the Pacific Legal Foundation. So that case has to do with SORNA. And again, I'll be talking about that in a bit. I'm trying to let people into the room. I can only do so much, folks. I'm sorry. There we go. As far as multitask. But anyway, so yeah, And I'll talk about more about the Thorn Cave in a while. It's progressing. It's slowly. More, I think it's more like a glacier. In the cases I work on, move a lot more quickly than this. But hey, this is how they move. Okay. And there was another question. How many are estimated to be at the vigil? We have 71 people who've signed up for the conference. I hope that every single person at the conference will be inspired to come to the vigil the next day. We shall see. And so my best guess is 100 people. Okay. Got the excellent letter sent to Mr. Roberts. So I think that reference is to the letter that we in fact sent to the U.S. Supreme Court justices. It is available on the Axtell website. And we basically said, hey, we're coming. And oh, by the way, you, the court, made a big mistake. And oh, by the way, Mr. Roberts, since you're part of this, I swear, this, you know, he was part of the mistake, right? He was the attorney representing the state of Alaska who said that registration is not punishment. And unfortunately, the court agreed with him. So, yeah, as far as I'm concerned, he owes us a big apology. And even more than that is overturning the case. So, and the influence he can have as Chief Justice, by the way, is that when a case is being considered for review, he can say, yeah, let's take this case and let's go. Yeah. Is this meeting video kept or just audio? If you're talking about today's meeting, it is being recorded, yes. And it will be kept on the Axtell website and people will be able to view it later. Okay. There's a lot of questions here, folks. I'm not going to be able to answer, but maybe Jeff can. As I said, I'm doing my best to multitask here. But any expected extra pushback with the new administration? Well, who knows? I'm not expecting any extra pushback. I'm not sure that they know we exist, and that might be a good thing. However, comma, I will tell you that we have prepared a letter. This is Axon. We have prepared a letter that will be sent tomorrow to the DOGE, D-O-G-E, Department of Government Efficiency, led by Elon Musk. So that letter has been drafted. Board members were asked to comment upon it, and I will finalize it on Monday, and we will send it on Monday to Mr. Musk and his group. I can't call it an agency. I don't even want to call it a department. To me, departments are authorized by Congress, and this hasn't been authorized by Congress, but there I go, being a lawyer. So anyway, in this letter, the important thing we're asking is, hey, DOGE, you're so busy slashing funding for all these government agencies and for all these government activities. We think you should slash the funding, in fact, eliminate the funding for anything involved related to SORNA. SORNA, think about it, okay? No more Angel Watch, no more, you know, so many things that are related to SORNA and spread out among many different agencies, by the way. And our best estimate is it would save the, you know, if he's really interested in saving money, we would think it would. Yes, I will post a letter to DOGE after it's finalized on Monday. It will be finalized. Okay, it's not final yet. But that the government would save at least $10 billion a year. That's a big number, right? So $10 billion a year. So hey, and you know, then they want to go spend the money on other things. Well, that's another matter I won't be addressing today. But the fact is that the fact is again that we are writing the letter to DOGE and we're asking them to eliminate all funding for SORNA. That would improve the lives of registrants throughout the nation. What's our chance of success? I don't know. Probably pretty small. But the fact is, you know, they can't even start thinking about it until we give them the idea. Another organization has in fact sent a letter already, the Florida Action Committee. They shared their letter with me, asked me not to distribute it to anyone because they're afraid that it'll end up on social media. I tell you what, when we send our letter, I hope it ends up on social media. So I don't understand their concern, but you know, I agreed to keep it private, and so I'm keeping it private. And I just noticed that we have another Axtell board member who joined. Welcome, Ellie. Ellie Miller is here. She's an Axtell board member, and like Jeff Stein, she's also a criminal defense attorney.
Good morning.
Good morning, Ellie.
Good morning.
She has another big credential, and that is she's also a law professor at Loyola in Los Angeles. So we got the, you know, we have the state pretty well covered geographically. So I'm up here in Sacramento. Jeff is out on the Central Coast, and Ellie's in Los Angeles. That doesn't happen too often in these monthly meetings. So welcome everybody. Okay, another thing that has changed since you got the information, about this meeting is in fact a proposed change to the passport application. Isn't this fascinating? So I wrote a short article about it yesterday. The draft or the proposed regulation was in fact included in that. But what the State Department is planning to do here is to add a statement to the passport application that basically says, I'm not required to register as a sex offender. Negative. I am not required to register as a sex offender. I actually find that fascinating. Now, they're not asking anybody to identify themselves as a quote sex offender, but they're just basically making everybody say who's not say that I'm not a sex offender, and it's, I'm still scratching my head about this one. So Axel is going to come up with a letter to to the federal government, basically saying, "Gosh, gee whiz, you're cutting. Sorry, you're causing some confusion here. Why the heck are you doing that?" I mean, I think it actually might benefit people who are required to register, but this is the other thing. They go in accordance with the international Megan's Law. And the reason that I say it that way, I mean, that's what it says. The reason it causes me concern is because we're not sure what the heck International Megan's Law says about who a quote sex offender is. And this kind of, is related to, connected with the SORNA litigation, in that under the SORNA and the SORNA litigation, the federal government is arguing that everybody who's ever been, everyone ever been convicted of a sex offense is a sex offender and therefore subject to SORNA. And I'm concerned that there's going to be the same darn thing here with a passport application. And by the way, this is not just a little throwaway comment. You have to like attest under the penalty of perjury that this is correct. So stand by. But if you want to weigh in on our website, do so. If you want to send a comment to the federal government about this, and even if you want to say, "Hey, I'm confused. What do you mean by?" and then ask your question. But they're taking comments from until March 7th. Until March 17, you comment upon this proposed federal regulation, which would add a statement to all passport applications, basically saying, asking people to verify that they're not required to register as a sex. Ellie, does that cause you any concern if you thought about it?
It kind of is makes people put a limitation on them that's no legal basis. Not everybody wants it.
Right.
I mean,
Mostly, I'm concerned how they're getting this information. And if somebody answers it wrong and innocently answers it wrong, like, okay, let's see who's, Brent, you're no longer required to register, right? So what if you don't check that box? Right? No, you do check the box because you're not required to register. Well, if their interpretation is that you are required, that their definition rather of sex offender includes anybody ever convicted of a sex offense, and you answer that, wrong in their opinion, and then what happened? I just see a whole bunch of litigation in the future about this. Jeff, do you have any thoughts? Anything you wanted to add
No,
here?
I think you got it up pretty closely.
Okay. All right. Maybe I just worry too much. I don't know. But I just see these things and all these red flags go up. It kind of reminds me, these days of that quote unique identifier that's added to the passports of people convicted of an offense involving a minor and who are required to register under any in any one state or more, right? And the language itself is so vague and ambiguous because it says this person has been convicted of a sex offense involving a minor, but they don't define the term minor. And so the country that's receiving it or reading this notice on your passport, well, the age of consent there might be 12, right? And your victim might be 16. Well, I mean, come on, folks, right? And then it doesn't say how long ago the conviction was. So it just raises so many questions. And I really think, at first, I don't think there should be a unique identifier added at all. But if there's going to be, then they need to be more precise in language. So anyway, that's, I guess, maybe subject for a future lawsuit.
One thing too, the next 4 years, we don't know what's going to happen with any, department in the government. I mean, Social Security, the IRS, and nobody's going to know what to do. And while that is apparent right now that nobody knows what to do. Anyway.
Yeah. I like the comment here about somebody should tell Justice Roberts that the difference with Price Club is that membership is not mandatory and you have to let everyone know you're a member. Let's see. I would agree. IML, the Angel Watch Center, sent a notice to the country I was traveling to. I got barred for life from all GCC countries. I'm not sure what that stands for because of this compelled speech. Can't visit my wife now. G Street? Does anybody know what that stands for? Maybe you could put in the chat what GCC stands for. Yeah. I have an experience I just went through recently. I would like to share. It involves me traveling to the United States. Yes. Right. And so that can be even more problematic, believe it or not, than traveling overseas. So, okay. Does somebody have a comment or question?
I
If
do.
not, okay,
That was me.
Barb. Okay.
I don't know how this meeting works. All I know is that I was referred to by a friend from a partner from a 12-step meeting.
Okay. Welcome.
And I wanted to share my experience of what I went through recently, and it really traumatized me.
Okay. Was it specific to a
Well,
legal
it's not
issue or a law?
passport. It's not traveling internationally. It's traveling nationally. It involves me going to Florida.
Okay. can you hold on for just a minute, Clark, and remind me, okay? Because I'm going to talk about domestic travel in just a few minutes.
Thank you.
You're certainly welcome. Okay, I wanted to talk about Section 8 housing first. It's a topic that I sometimes forget to talk about, but folks, I want you to know that as long as you're not on a registry for life, you are eligible to live in section housing. Okay, so let me put in the positive. If you are in California, if you're on Tier 1 or Tier 2, you are now eligible to live in Section 8 housing. There's a federal rule against it. It's a regulation, not a law, but they're unfortunately enforce this regulation pretty strongly. That basically says if you're a lifetime registrant, you cannot live in, much less obtain, Section 8 housing. That has really hurt a lot of people on the register. So in California, one of the side benefits, collateral benefits, if I can call it, is in fact that it makes you eligible, if you're on Tier 1 or Tier 2, it makes you eligible to live in Section 8 housing. So, and if you, unfortunately, not all the federal people know about this, and I have in fact written memos on behalf of individuals assigned to Tier 1 or assigned to Tier 2, and based upon my memo, that just explains that there's been a change in the law here in California. So based on my memo, many people are now getting Section 8 housing. So I'm making the offer right now for people in the meeting today and people in the future. If in fact this applies to you, you've been assigned to Tier 1 or Tier 2 in California, and you've been denied Section 8 housing, contact, and I will write a memo too. I make it very specific, by the way. It's not just an generic memo. Okay, so that it means for me, I'm looking at the agenda I put together here, and that it's time to talk about domestic and international travel. I've kind of talked a little bit about overseas travel because I've talked about passports, but I don't really want to talk about that travel yet. I want to talk about domestic travel. And so the gentleman who was just wanting to speak, you would identify, oh, there you are, Clark. Okay. And I'll just say before Clark starts speak that in fact, traveling domestically can in fact be difficult because you really have to navigate all these different state laws. And I do mean different. If only every state had the same requirements, it might be easier to navigate, but unfortunately it doesn't. So Clark, please share with us a story.
Okay. So this story is very recent. It was from 2 days ago. I was scheduled to go to Florida. I am from New Jersey. I currently have a charge of having photos I shouldn't have had on my phone, third degree possession, and I was not required to register as a sex offender. I'm not on any kind of list, nothing at all. So I flew down to Florida, and every time I go somewhere within the United States, I have to have a travel form, and I have to show that to the local police department or local sheriff's department or any kind of organization within the United States. They have to sign that for me, and they determine if I'm required to register. 80% of the time, it's a no, I don't have to register because I'm not registered in New Jersey. Last year, before the House Bill 1235 got passed in Florida, I had no issues. I didn't have to register. I was there for 2 weeks, like I always am, and I've been doing this 2023. I was on my way, and that's it. Now this year was very different. And this is in Palm Beach County, by the way. So I went to the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Department, and I handed them the paper, and they go, and they went into the back for 10 minutes, and they came back. Okay, so now you do have to register. And I didn't really know about the house. I have no idea about it, and I was wondering why do I have to register this year, and I didn't have to register last year. And they said, oh, we don't know, we can't tell you. So my dad, who was a lawyer, not for title insurance, not for this kind of stuff, he just said, you're not going to register as a sex offender. you know, take that paper back, get your license back, come home, I'll look at it. So while I'm driving away from the sheriff's department and driving to my dad's house in Florida, I get a call from a Palm Beach detective, and he is harassing me, telling me, I don't care if you're from New Jersey or any kind of other state in this great country that we live in, you're going to go back and register if you're going to be here. Otherwise, you will get thrown in jail. I'm telling you right now, if you don't listen to what I say, then there's going to be problems. So, you know, the next day, my dad was thinking hard on it, thinking about it, thinking about, should I leave? Should I stay? Obviously, we decided that I leave. And the day I left, I actually got a call from the sheriff, from the detective again. And he's like, I see you didn't get the paper filled out yet on my system. And he goes, well, and then he says, and let me tell you something else. You know where your address is, you're within 1,000 feet of a playground. So you're not really authorized to be there. So,
excuse
you know,
me, Clark, is that where your father lives, within 1,000 feet of a playground?
Yes, he lives by the beach, and I, I don't know if there is a playground there, but that's what he was saying. That there's 1,000 feet. It's 1,000 feet of a playground. He lives in a condo, and he just told you know he basically you know he so after he, I got the second phone call, I was scared shitless, and I just like ran to the airport and took the next flight out. I feel like I was basically kicked out of Florida, and because you know, and keep in mind, I have no issues in New Jersey. I'm on probation. I report every 2 weeks, 1 week on the phone, another 2 weeks more in person. I have a year left of probation. I've been on probation for three years, no violation, nothing at all. And, you know, I've never had a problem anywhere I go. I've been to New York. I've been to Connecticut. I've had no problem at all anywhere. For some reason, because of that, and now I know, because of that house bill, Bill 35, that's the reason why I had to register, based on the lawyers that I spoke to.
Okay, Clark, so, I'm going to ask you to stop talking right now. And so we got three attorneys here can address your situation. Jeff or Illy, do you want to go first?
Sure. So the basic idea is that the national laws created by Congress, state laws are created in each state legislative system. The federal law doesn't prevent or cause your registration in the state. The state law does. So when you travel from a state based upon your non-registration status there and you go to another state, the arrival state under local state law has the authority to look at what the conviction was and decide whether it replicates a required registration in your state. So California has a law like this, Penal Code Section 290.005, and basically it says that if you're convicted anywhere outside of California or in federal jurisdiction, they have to evaluate the requirements proof. In the law, we call it the elements of the offense. And if the elements of the offense in your state of conviction match a California offense that requires registration, then you have to register for that. My guess is what you ran into in Florida was a Florida law pretty much like 290.005. And so they evaluated what they found on the FBI conviction document and they imposed the registration requirement. Or it could have just been a cop who was overzealous, but that would be the legal underpinning if that was legally appropriate.
Thank you, Jeff. And Ellie, do you want to add to that?
No, I don't. Jeff's explained it well, but I just need to know. What's the number of the bill again?
I don't recall, but Clark, are you still here? Could you either tell us?
Yes, it's called House Bill 1235.
1235. And do you know when it was passed?
It was passed October of 2024. And I was there last year from February 22nd to March 5th.
1025 is the bill?
1235.
Okay.
So, folks, I think this underscores what we're talking about. Visiting, if you're on the registry and you're visiting another state, you have to be extremely careful, okay, about what the registration requirements are. And, Jeff, you explained well about California. So, California requires people from other states to register if there's equivalent offense, even if you're not longer required to register in that state, by the way. Okay, other states are similar, but not all the states are the same. And so it's really, really tedious as an attorney to go through this, but it needs to be done. Or even what I often recommend people do is contact an attorney in that state that you're going to visit, because it's the attorneys in that state are going to be even better educated and prepared to give you answers about how long can you stay in that state without registering. Now, why do you think that every single month we talk about not registering in another state? Folks, this is really, really important when it comes to the international Megan's Law, okay? And specifically when it comes to having to have an identifier added to your passport. Because if, in fact, you're required to register in any state, okay, and Florida is one of the worst, New York is right up there too, in that once you register in those states, they never take you off the registry. There's even been a court case in Florida that the family of a deceased registrant basically filed to try to get their loved one's name off of the Florida registry, and the court said they didn't have to. So think about it. There's a dead person, and that can't be the only dead person on the Florida registry. I mean, folks, this makes no sense. If the reason that there's a registry is to help monitor people who are alive, right, and their whereabouts, why in the heck would you put a dead person on a registry, much less keep them on the registry? So there Franco being logical and reasonable. And as you know, that the laws here are not always logical and reasonable. But Jeff and Ellie and I and the other attorneys were trying to help guide you through this. And so, you know, folks, please take it seriously. You could end up basically violating a registration law in another state and ending up in state prison, their state prison, because you didn't know what the laws were. Now, some states say, well, you have to have knowledge of the law, but some states say ignorance of the law is no excuse. We're going to put you in jail no matter what. So think about it hard. Think about it, whether or not, you know, how much risk will you're comfortable taking for this particular reason. And like, you know, I've had people tell me, okay, first I'm going to say, don't go to the South. Okay. So anybody who saw the movie Easy Rider, you know, you should stay away from the South, number one. But number two, when it comes to people on the registry, don't go to the South. They're vicious. They're vicious. They're mean, right? They go out of their way, just like they did with Clark there from New Jersey. They just go out of their way to make your life miserable and keep you guessing about whether or not you have to do something, right? And I think that Clark did absolutely the right thing by getting the heck out of the state of Florida. I hope he never goes back. And I hate to say that because it sounds like his father lives in Florida and he wants to go visit his dad, which only makes sense, right? But it looks like they're going to have to meet some other place because Florida is a very hostile state to people in the region. So, and one of the things that I've learned over the years, by the way, and this is actually fairly recent, I'd say within the last 12 months, one of the things that you can do, you know, is always looking for hacks, right? But talk about hacks. How do you navigate safely? You can basically travel by train. So if you take a train trip, there's a really good chance that you can see the country without violating any of the laws. The worst laws are Nevada and Florida, 48 hours. Okay, 2 days, that's it. If you spend more than 2 days there, you have to register. So why would you register there? You know, and Florida, by the way, they don't make you come back every year to re-register. They just won't let go of you. It's kind of like that song about Hotel California, check out but never leave. That's Florida. Okay, they are not going to take you off their registry. They love you so much. No, they want to persecute you. They want to punish you so much. They are not going to take you off their registry. So why give them that opportunity? Just don't register in Florida. And I know sometimes it's not possible. I know I've heard such sad stories, and one in particular that I'm thinking about, his father was dying in Florida and he wanted to be there with his dad, and finally bit the bullet and he registered in Florida because it was that important to him to be to be with his father. It only makes sense. We want to be with our loved one. But the fact is now he's on the registry for life. So, you know, we all have to make our decision. One thing that I get this call from time to time, it's usually in the summertime, and they go, I want to take a car trip. I want to travel across the United States. And my heart just stops beating because I'm like, oh my goodness, how many states are you going to drive through? How long are you going to plan to stay in these states? And of course, I don't know. So what I'm going to tell you is, if you're going to plan a car trip like that, please, please, please plan ahead and don't end up registering in a whole bunch of states, because that will just complicate your lives immeasurably, right? And for no good reason. It is possible to do it, but you really need to plan. So don't just head out on the road. We Americans like to do that, you know, stock up on our snack food and our songs, our music. But the fact is, plan ahead, and you can do it. You can, but you need to plan. Plan accordingly. And by the way, even with traveling by train, you need a backup plan. So I understand sometimes train break. That's why I don't take them. But the fact is, if that should happen, you need to get out of there. Okay. You need to make sure that you know what the requirement is to register and avoid that requirement. So that might require getting in a rental car and driving to the next state or something like that. But just that is my advice, my strong recommendation. Jeff and Ellie, do you want to weigh in here?
Planning is the key. And I think it seems counterintuitive, but if you want to go anywhere outside of California, you need to know what risks you're engaging. Part of the underlying motivation for the SORNA lawsuit that Janice is going to talk about later is that failing to register under the federal obligation creates a 10-year prison exposure. And all of these opportunities are just incumbent on you as the person at risk to get to the final answer before you go.
And Ellie?
Well, I have a question for Clark. I don't know if he is still on the meeting, but I'm just wondering, because on probation that makes Clark, is it because you're on probation that makes you go to the police station before you travel?
Yes. Every time I have to go somewhere, I always have to let my probation officer know that, hey, you know, I am going here, I'm going there, right? So the time I'm on probation, I have to have a form and I have to give the police department or whatever kind of department the form. They sign it. They determine if I have to register. So that's the reason why, like, you know, I ran into that problem in the first place anyway, I think.
So if your probation terminates in another year, then that won't have to happen.
I know. And I, you know what, like I said, I wasn't even expecting anything like this to happen because, you know, last year I had absolutely no issues at all. You know, I was in and out of that department in like a minute, signed it, boom, and I was on my way out, you know. So I was in there for a good 20 minutes and I was told I had to register. And then that whole thing started. It was very traumatic to deal with.
Clark, I'm really sorry that you had that experience. And unfortunately, I'm not surprised. And I don't know if you were on earlier when I was talking about the fact that it's really going to be problematic for you to visit your dad in the future in Florida. So you might need to make other plans.
But... Yeah, I am currently looking into going to California because I have some time on my vacation left. Because I know that their laws for visiting are very lenient, very, you know, relaxed. So I think if I stay for like 10 days, I won't have to register because a lawyer told me
it's
no.
Not true. It's 5 days.
5 days?
Five days or after your birthday or on arrival.
Yeah. So, So check in with us. Hawaii is, I think, the only state that I know that has a 10-day requirement. It's 10 days for each trip and I think a total of 30 days for the entire calendar year in Hawaii. But anyway, we do have information, folks, on our website regarding domestic travel and what the rules are. We did not gather this information. A third party did, but I think more or less it's accurate. I will tell you, folks, that really you need to do your homework. Jeff, earlier you said planning, planning, planning. I say planning, planning, planning. I'm sure Ellie would agree. You need to plan. You need to plan ahead when you visit another state. And I'm telling you that the laws are absolutely different state to state. By the way, just because you're not required to register in one state, like even in California, if you are lucky enough to have your petition granted and over 80,000 people have, and therefore you're no longer required to register in California, that does not mean you don't have to register in another state if you visit there, okay? So I often tell people there's a cheap way to do this and there's an expensive way to do it. And what I mean by that, the cheap way is just if you act as if you're still on the registry, okay, this is for people who are no longer required to register in California. If you pretend, if you act as if you're still on the registry, you won't violate, okay? And so that's a cheap way. The expensive way is you contact an attorney in that state ahead of time and figure out what their rules are. Because I did this recently for a client and he was like, oh, I think I want to visit a bunch of states. I said, no. Let's get down to two. What are the two most important states for you to visit? Let's look at the laws there. And he's no longer required to register in California, but it was Nevada. And I'm trying to remember what the other state was. And I basically told him the safe thing to do was to avoid registration in those states. Okay. Even though he's no longer required to register of Florida. Florida was one of them. I go, don't go to Florida, right? Because in Florida, the way I read the Florida law is even though he's no longer required to register in California for that offense, in Florida, he would be required to register. So you spend 48 hours there, boom, you have to register. So hopefully he's heeding my advice. But we never know, we attorneys, right? We give folks our best advice and recommendations, and sometimes people follow them and sometimes they don't. And, you know, I don't want to frighten anybody. Again, I don't want to tell you that you can't travel. You can, but you just have to be careful about doing it. So we've been talking about domestic travel, and I think based on time, it's time to move on to overseas travel. Overseas travel, in some respects, it's easier, but in other respects, it's more complicated. I mean, if you're going to go overseas, you're going to have a passport. There's just no doubt about it, okay? You're going to have a passport. You take the passport, you apply for the passport, and when you do, the question is whether or not you have to have a unique identifier added to your passport. And this is basically the rule. It's a federal law. It's not a rule. The federal law says if you were convicted of an offense involving a minor, that means under 18. So even though some states' age of consent is less than 18, it means under 18. And you're required to register in any one state, including Florida, right? So even though you're not actively registering, they keep you on the registry. That's considered registered. If those two factors apply to you, then you have to have a unique identifier added to your passport eventually. And the crazy thing about this is the State Department can come and revoke your passport at any time if you don't have a unique identifier, okay? And again, the term, by the way, under the International Megan's Law is covered sex offender. So if you are a covered sex offender, then you must have a unique identifier added to your passport at some point in time. The danger if you don't already have the unique identifier on your your passport is that the State Department can revoke your passport at any time, and maybe without notice. I mean, I have a client who that happened to, and he was flying from Los Angeles with his wife to Europe. They were planning to be in Europe for 3 weeks. They had prepaid, you know, lodging and all this other stuff. And, you know, they got their boarding passes. They were checked into the flight. They were sitting on the plane just about, you know, waiting for the plane to take off when somebody from Department of Homeland Security came literally and basically tapped him on the shoulder and told him he had to get off the plane. And he said, why? And they said, because your passport has been revoked. And he said, no, it isn't. I have my passport right here. They took the passport from his hand and they said, no, you don't have a passport anymore. And he and his wife had to get off that plane. They never got to Europe. They wasted tens of thousands of dollars on all this lodging and, you know, the good time that they were going to have. So that's why people ask me, should I get a unique identifier added to my passport? I grit my teeth and say, yes. If you want to travel overseas, and again, you're a covered sex offender, then yes, you should have the unique identifier added to your passport to avoid what has been happening. Now, other people basically come home from an overseas trip, some of them, and they get a letter. And actually, they're even sending these letters by email now, which I think is pretty gutsy. They're getting a letter saying, your passport's been revoked. You need to apply for a new passport. Okay. And you're like, but I have a passport right here. There's nothing wrong with it, except for the fact it's been revoked. So if you try to, and the letter says, if you try to travel with that passport, the revoked passport, that's a felony. So folks, we're just telling you what is happening. We don't agree with this. I vehemently disagree with it. I don't know, Jeff or Ellie, do you want to add something here?
Well, no, I think you're spot on.
The only thing I want to say is that I had a client contact me. He's not he's not in the registry, but he was flying to Egypt via London and had to get a visa. And they were asking him about his criminal convictions. And he was in a panic because he was planning to leave the very next day. And so even people with convictions that are not registrable offenses have issues traveling overseas.
Yes, I do have one small illustration and an anecdote way that might be helpful to people. One of the questions that comes up is travel to Mexico. Mexico and Canada are both restrictive spaces to get into based on previous criminal conviction. So the circumstance was a California resident client who's on the registry wanted to go to Mexico to get dental work done, because dental work can be done more inexpensively there. And so I spent some time investigating what the risks were. I found it pretty clear that if flew in to the area where the dentist was, he would likely get stopped and get turned around. That's what I had reported from colleagues in the San Diego area who I work with. So what the client did, which was a suggestion that had come to me from one of my contacts, was he went to the border and he walked across. He walked in, he had no problem once he was in. He got his dental work done. And when he got ready to leave, he walked back across. He had no problems leaving. So the takeaway that I had was that it's a different world for flying in through customs than it is walking through the crowds border. And so if you want to go to at least to Mexico, that's been a success.
And like Jeff, I've heard reports of this. We're certainly not giving legal advice about what to do, but we've heard reports from many people that about what they've been able to do as far as entering Mexico. So let's talk about other countries as well. And Jeff mentioned Canada. You know what, folks? Canada doesn't let people who are required to register into their country. But I feel a little bit better about Canada than Mexico, because when it comes to Canada, they don't allow anybody convicted of a felony into their country without some paperwork. So it can be done. If you really need to go to Canada, or you really have this burning desire to go to Canada, contact a Canadian attorney. I can even refer you to one who can basically navigate you through the process. It can be done, but it takes time and a little bit of money to be able to do that. The easiest travel, overseas travel these days for a person on the registry is going to Europe. Okay. I'm happy to report that there are 21 nations, and those nations are part of something, a consortium called the Schengen, S-H-E-N-G. Some kind of consortium. Trust me, it was not put together just for us. But they are wise enough to know that that our laws in the United States don't make any sense. And so they're like, we don't care if you come here or not. The four largest of those countries, by the way, are Italy, Spain, Germany, and France. Those are really big countries, and there's a lot to see in those countries. But there's also 25 smaller countries, and you can visit those countries. Now, things change. Okay, for a long time, the Schengen nations, a lot of people in in without a problem. I don't know if there's going to be a problem this year or not, but you need to know about something called ETIAS. Somebody's already put it in the chat room here. I don't remember what the acronym stands for, but it's E is an echo, T is tango, I is an igloo, A is an alpha, S is Sam. So the ETIAS system, it's going to require you not to get a visa, but to get a permit. Okay, so now to go to those Schengen nations, you're going to need to get a permit. So what in the heck is that and what does it take? My understanding is something that you can apply for online. It costs less than 10 euros and it supposedly is added to your passport electronically. I don't know about you, but that spooks me. What do you mean it's going to be added electronically? I don't know. You know, I guess we're way past Big Brother and having to worry about Big Brother. We can not have Big Brother, but big sisters and the whole family to think about. But the fact is that ETIAS system looks like it might be kind of easy to navigate, but this is my one concern. They say in there the application for this permit, they ask if you have ever been convicted of a serious offense. And then it doesn't define what a serious offense is. So I'm concerned that they might say anybody who's ever been convicted of a sex offense, and supposedly it's only within the last 10 years, but are they going to basically say anybody who's currently required to register, you know, is in fact that's a serious offense and it's a current offense? I don't know. Those are questions that I can ask easily, but I don't know the answers to them. Now, here's the deal. ETIAS system is not currently in place. It's supposed to be in place in May of this year. And supposedly in May of this year, it's going to be something that's available, but not required. So May of 2025, we're only talking about 3 months from now, folks, that is going to be available, that you can apply for it online, pay your 10 euros, and hopefully you'll get this electronic addition to your passport. In November of this year, it's supposed to be mandatory. And I'm just telling you what's available online, but we don't know for sure when these things are going to actually become available and become required. The date, because the dates keep changing. And it's not us that's changing the dates, it's the Europeans that are changing the date. Why this is being done, I don't know. I hear multiple possibilities, including the fact, I guess, we require in our state to require Europeans to do something like this, and maybe it's retaliation. But the fact is, you need to know that if you go visit the Europe and these European nations that will allow registrants to issue, starting in May, you can get a permit to visit them. And in November, you must get a permit to visit them. So does anybody have a question, I guess, about the permits or this overseas travel, including the passport identifiers?
I'm super confused. I think I'm going to have to reach out to you individually, Janice.
Okay, you certainly can do that. Yeah, folks, it is confusing because the definition of who's a covered sex offender can be confusing, right? So about whether or not to get a unique identifier. And by the way, this is a crazy thing. If you want to get a unique identifier added to your passport at this point in time, you have to ask for it. You have to ask for it. And to me, that just rubs me the wrong way with a lot of exclamation points. Why in the heck would anybody ask for a unique identifier? Well, folks, it's for the reason I told you. Otherwise, your passport can be revoked at any time. So that's the downside of not getting a unique identifier added. And by the way, I want you to know, I don't know how many people who are on the call today know or who's going to listen to this later, but I filed a challenge. I filed a lawsuit in federal district court here in California about the international migrants law. And the case was dismissed. The judge basically said we lack standing to even challenge it. And I mean, that just made me crazier about it, because I had seven plaintiffs in the case, and seven plaintiffs, two of them had wives in the Philippines, and their wives couldn't get out of the United States and they couldn't get to the Philippines. I really don't know what had happened to those folks. That's been over 6 years ago. And I really reminding myself now I should check in with them to see how they're doing and how their marriage is surviving. So like Jeff told the story about people being able to successfully walk across the border to Mexico, I've also heard stories about people flying from the United States to Europe. And then once they're in their Europe, they buy a ticket to go some other place. Okay. So, and successfully gone to those other countries. Like, for example, right now, Asia is off limits to people who are on the register. They're just off limit. All those Asian countries. Hong Kong is iffy right now. There was a time in the past where people could visit Hong Kong, registrants could, but now I understand people are being turned, some people, but not all people are being turned away. It's a huge expense, folks, as you can well imagine. imagine to get to Hong Kong, only to be turned away. So, but again, stories that I've heard consistently are some people, in fact, are buying a ticket to a Shingen nation, maybe staying there for a couple of days or whatever, and then they buy a ticket to go to another country that might, in fact, be otherwise hostile. Part of this, folks, is that our government, the U.S. government, is basically reviewing the manifests of every flight that starts in the United States and going overseas, okay? And if they identify somebody on one of those manifests who is, in fact, a registrant or a covered sex offender, according to IML, they will send a notice to the country to which traveling. So that country, when you arrive, they already know that you're on your way and that you're, you know, and what flight you're on and what day and time, all this other stuff, they already know. And so some of these countries are going to turn you away because they got a notice from our country that basically says, you know, this language, and I'm paraphrasing, that this person has been convicted of a sex offense involving a minor. So that chills me to the bone, but yeah. Okay. Do I have any questions about overseas travel before we go on? Looking for hands up. You can unmute yourself and speak, but or not. Okay. All right.
Just as a supplemental, there's fairly good information on Google under ETIAS, which is an acronym for European Travel Information and Authorization. Kind of like Janice said, it's a retaliatory visa that the Europeans are getting even. I think you're muted, Janice.
Thank you. I meant to turn off the video, not the audio. See, people saw me eating a cashew, sorry. The fact is, I was just warning people that there may be some more rough roads ahead given the current administration and tariffs. I don't know if that's going to, then keep going, rippling, when the ripple effects stuff to affect people who are going to travel to other countries. I hope not. I certainly hope not. Okay. Thank you, Ellie,
Janice,
for that comment.
I'm just going to ask my one that I put in the chat just because it's eating at me. So I'm in the process of part of my plea agreement was that it was going to drop my charge from in Utah felony 3, which is the lowest degree felony, down to a misdemeanor. What is that really going to do as far as any of these things are concerned? If they end up dropping it to one that's non-regible here, does that change anything in any other state? Does it change it with identifiers, with passports? I mean, other than it looking better, that it's no longer a higher degree charge, does it do anything for me in any of these cases?
Yes. I don't think it's relevant when it comes to international Megan's law, whether it's a misdemeanor or a felony. Fact is, if you have an offense involving a minor, again, under the age of 18, they don't care if it's a misdemeanor or a felony. So they think that the IML would still apply to you. As far as visiting other states, I think it would make a difference. But remember what I said and Jeff said, and I think Ellie at least nodded her head in agreement, which is that you need to really prepare yourself if you're going to go visit another state, because in some states, it doesn't make any difference. I'm serious. It's in reading some of these state laws let's take rape. Okay. So if somebody's convicted of rape in one state, by the way, it could be statutory rape, right? So, I mean, you have to look at the state law, which says if anybody comes to visit our state, this is when people would have to start registering. Oh, by the way, it only applies to people convicted of certain offenses, but their offenses have a different title than your conviction offense. It gets really murky and complicated. So I can't give you a complete answer, John. I think your suggestion earlier was a good one, which is contact me or Jeff or Melly outside this meeting. Because folks, one of the other things is we're being recorded, so you may not want to disclose all of your facts in a recording.
I can add a piece that might be helpful to people in the same situation, John, that you're in. So your description was they were going to take some action to change the charge potentially from a felony to a misdemeanor. I think this gets into the weeds a little bit, but it's probably important to understand. The question of what specific behavior legally is taking place in your case may be the controlling fact. So if the conviction is vacated, that's a term of art meaning it's removed from its status as being an actual conviction that you suffered, that's different than if what they do is they recharacterize the consequence for it. So in California, which of course wouldn't affect your Utah case, if you can get the original conviction vacated, it means it doesn't have continuing legal significance, or at least it has a greatly diminished legal significance. In my experience, a couple of clients where we've got the conviction vacated using a Latin phrase, nunc pro tunc, which means now as if then, the legal effect should be no conviction and remain. It's problematic always to get to an answer on these things because you have to either be in contact with the record keeper in your state, or you have to go through a court process in your state where the conviction takes place. And I think a really critical thing is to get a lawyer local to where you want to have this change in the nature of your case and find out what the change actually being made is. Is the conviction being eliminated as if it never happened? That's what vacating would imply. Or is it just a penalty or consequence that are being recurred?
So it's what they consider a 4023 reduction in Utah, basically changing the severity from a felony three to either they do a one-step or a two-step reduction. So I don't know if it necessarily vacates the original plea or the original entry in the record, or if it just adds another entry to the record.
I think that's a really useful question to ask your lawyer in Utah. I can tell you just as a small anecdote, I came on with a case that someone had been convicted of in the county that I normally practice in with an agreement that if he succeeded on probation, conviction for the two consequential offenses would be vacated using this Latin nunc pro tunc. It ended up taking us about 18 months of litigation before we got that finalized with the California Department of Justice because their routine is that they don't make those kinds of changes. The record keepers normally report that their role is not to make the record, it's to take what they're told by the local agencies, could be courts or it could be police department, as to what's showing up as significant in current record. So you can't really generically answer this. You have to get the specifics in your case and drill down enough to for you to be able to know what is actually the conviction that's finalized on the record after the remedies that you get in the successful completion of probation state.
Okay. Yeah. And I mean, I am going to need to work with you guys too, because I did, I was living in California for while I was going through sentencing and everything. So I did register in California. So I'm going to need kind of help if I do get them to be able to release me from being registered here. So,
well, one of the benefits actually of being registered in California is if you leave the state, you're no longer on the registry.
Okay. Yeah. Cause they told me they were just going to put me as like non-active or something, even though I told them I moved here. So
I'm not comfortable with that term, non-active, inactive. I'm having a situation with another state right now, and they're telling me something similar, and I don't believe it. I don't.
Yeah, because when I was living in Hacienda Heights, and and that when I went in there and I told them I was moving back to Utah, she updated it and said that, you know, it was my information was still there, but it wasn't active. So I don't know how that worked.
Well, I think the general rule is, again, if you leave the state of California and you do it with proper notice, you're not on the California registry anymore. Were you convicted in California?
No, in Utah.
Okay. I'm going to move on, folks. I'm going to move on. We've got quite a few questions here in the chat room. One is to ask, if you only have to register in California and you are not federally obliged to register, are you a covered sex offender? Maybe. Folks, that's not the determining factor. By the way, this is it. If you were convicted of a sex offense involving a minor, and it does not have to be a hands-on offense, and it doesn't have to involve violence. So I'm talking, you know, about like possession of child pornography. That is a non-violent offense that does not include any physical contact. And yet that is considered by the IML to be a sex offense involving a minor. Okay. So, and so if in fact you are quote a covered sex offender, then yes, they can add the unique identifier to their passport. The law says that the State Department must add the unique identifier when you reapply for a passport. That's what it says. It also says that the State Department is authorized but not required to revoke a passport that does not have the identifier in it. So that's the danger. It's like this sword hanging over your head. If you don't have a unique identifier and you're a covered sex offender, that your passport can be revoked at any point in time. And that to me is certainly very dangerous. And by the way, when it comes to the unique identifier, this is how terrible it is. That it is a scarlet letter. And in the whole history of our planet, only two countries have ever added something like that to the passports of their citizens. The first country to do it was Nazi Germany. Guess what? If you were a Jew, they put a big red J on your passport. I have photos of those big red J's. And the second was USSR. Again, they identified members of their country that were Jews, and they didn't, and that was it, and marked their passports. And one of the arguments that I made in federal court trying to challenge the international migrants law was, in fact, that this is, you know, again, only two countries have ever done it, and And do we, the United States of America, want to be in the same category as Nazi Germany and the USSR? I posited we didn't, but the trial court judge obviously disagreed, and she dismissed the case. So anyway, somebody said they got their mark passport in the mail. Looking at the chat here, I'm not sure where that went. Mac. Okay. So I don't know, Mac, if you want to speak to this and your experience, was it difficult? Was it hard? Was it easy? Difficult or hard? Hopefully that it wasn't too painful. Is SORNA lawsuit nationwide? So let me talk about SORNA. We've talked about domestic travel. We've talked about overseas travel. Let's talk about SORNA, because that is one of the items certainly here on my list of topics to discuss today. The federal government issued regulations, SORNA regulations, new ones, 3 years ago now. Okay. And then the new regulations, they basically, this federal government tried to leap over the heads of state governments and tell people on the registry that they were required to do all kinds of things, even if their state laws did not require it. This is kind of one of those things where it's complicated from a legal point of view, because usually the federal government has primary jurisdiction, if I can call it that, when it comes to something like this. But well, it comes to a law. But the thing is that usually when it comes to criminal laws and such, it's the state governments that have primary jurisdiction and not the federal government. So Max says he can speak. Go ahead, Mike. Can you unmute yourself? He's going to talk about getting a passport with the unique identifier.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Hey, Janice. So I just got to the meeting here. So it was a week ago, I received an email from the State Department. When I opened the email, it said State Department. And so I was devastated. I was like, oh no, it's finally here. I was fully expecting it to be, come in the mail. So I opened it up and it said, it was dated February 13th. So this was on Valentine's morning when I opened it up, and I was out of town and in the process, in the middle of a trip, I travel internationally. So I was quite shocked that it came in an email and it said, effective immediately, your passport's revoked and any further use of it's a felon. So of course that got my attention right away. I went to the local passport office in that city I was at and went to apply. The persons there were very accommodating. They were super nice. I told the guy, I said, hey, look, this is a sensitive matter. I don't want to speak too loud. You know, I was up at a window. I said, this is, I need this stamp, yada, yada. And he said, hold on, let me check this out. So he came back and he goes, okay, I found out that we have to get some kind of direction from Washington. And of course, they're closed now for due to the time change. And so we won't know anything till after Tuesday. I said, all right, so I'll just leave this stuff here with the expedited fee and, we'll see. So yesterday, I live in Texas. It was in a priority mail envelope. I said, wow, that was quick. So I did get it, and it does have the stamp at the top of the page. So a few years ago, y'all probably know that those remarks were in the back of the passport. Mm-hmm. When they made amendments or changes, there was an amendment section. Well, now they moved that amendment section to the front of the passport. Passport style is a little bit different, and it's at the top of it. Luckily, it's kind of smaller print, so it's not as big as print as what is on the letter. So they attached a form letter with it that talks about the IML and what it is with the unique identifier. So some of y'all may know that process. I forgot who the gentleman was who forced the applicant to write this statement that's in the passport, because the passport bureau did not know to put it in. So they said, well, we don't have the manpower to look it up. So they were forcing people to write, three times on a blackboard, I will not, it's punishment, that you have to self-identify to do that. So right there, that is compelled speech. If you're forcing me to write that statement and say, you must put this in my passport, you are compelling me to do it, or else we're not going to give you a passport. So I put it in there. We'll see what happens, when I travel. Don't set the bear. Hopefully whoever's looking at it won't have their glasses on. That's the only thing I can say,
Okay. Well, thank you, Mac, for that. And I hope people were listening carefully to what Mac shared with us, including the fact that he paid an expedited fee to get his passport back as quickly as possible. He does travel internationally for a living, I know, because he's one of my clients. And so this is not just a matter of, I'd like to go see the Eiffel Tower again or have some pasta in Italy. So thank you. Thank you for sharing.
Well, I hope to be there in Washington. I'm trying to finagle my schedule, and we'll see if I could do that. I really, really would like
to. That'd be fabulous. We'd love to see you there. Thank you. Great.
Thanks, Janice. I appreciate it. Appreciate
it. You're welcome. Somebody says, I paperclipped my COVID vaccination card over the wording on my passport. That's a clever idea.
That's a good idea.
All right. I don't know. Something your kid's drawing from one of your kids. I don't know. COVID, I think, might be a little more official, shall we say. But that's a good idea. Okay. I moved on to SORNA. So the SORNA regulation, one of those things that makes me crazy. There's unfortunately a long list that keeps growing about things that make me crazy. And this is certainly one of them. So again, the federal government for many years tried to entice the state governments to become SORNA compliant. And they did this through something called the burn grants. And they basically said, well, if only you are a compliant state, then you too can be eligible for burn grants. Well, states like California, and actually 2/3 of the states in our country, said thanks, but no thanks. I know California reported to me that California figured it out and would cost more money to comply with SORNA than they could possibly get under a burn grant. So thanks, but no thanks. I don't know why other states chose not to do it, but I'm glad they didn't. So I'm serious. 2/3 of the states in our country have said thanks to no thanks to SORNA. So what happened with these new regulations is that the federal government basically jumped over the heads of state government to get directly to individuals who are required to register. And in doing so, they're basically saying, and if you don't comply with these regulations, you too could be in federal prison for up 10 years. So let me explain to me what I think is the clearest example of this. In most states, now I'll just say in California, just pointing out of California. In California, most people register only once a year, okay? But if the SORNA regulations applied to them, at least 40,000 people in our state would have to register not once a year, but 4 times a year. Well, a couple people decided to test the system after the SORNA regulations were published and went to their registration office and, 3 months later and go, I'm here again. I'm here for my quarterly registration. And they basically were told by their registration office that no, it's like California doesn't do that for most people. There are some exceptions, but for most people, it's once a year and that's it. Okay. So we've been fighting the SORNA regulations now for a couple of years through litigation. We, Axel, are a plaintiff in the lawsuit. We are not the litigator. So there's a much larger organization called the Pacific Legal Foundation. Their headquarters are actually in Sacramento, but most of their lawyers, and we're talking about more than 50 lawyers, they have in Washington. So they have the resources to take an important case like this. They've been before the U.S. Supreme Court many times. The last time count that I had was they'd been to the U.S. Supreme Court 7 times, and they won 14 of those cases. That's a damn good track record, isn't it? 14 out of 7. So we don't have any experience with the U.S. Supreme Court yet, so I can't say we have any losses, but then again, we don't have any wins. But anyway, the Pacific Legal Foundation filed earlier this year a motion for summary judgment. The federal government responded with their own motion for summary judgment, so the parties are battling it out in this case, and there's a hearing that's scheduled in Riverside, California on April 28th. So the hearing date again is April 28th. You can actually view the hearing online or you can be there in person. Now, the disadvantage for being there in person is this judge likes to change hearing date. I mostly believe that he doesn't want us to be in the audience. So I keep changing the hearing date to make it inconvenient. And I know the very first hearing in this case, I got myself, I booked a flight. I was going to be there and the hotel reservation, all that other stuff. And he changed the date and he changed it like 3 more times after that. So this is the second date he's chosen for these motions, and it's April 28th. But the good news is we can all observe it online if we want to. The judge has made an important ruling in the case. He basically granted a preliminary injunction that specifically says if you are on the registry in the state of California, the SORNA regulations do not apply to you. That's only one state, okay? He left 49 other states hanging out there. So I'm concerned. I wish that he would issue a broader preliminary injunction. We'll see if he will do that later. I don't know. So stay tuned. But again, it's a really important case, because one of the arguments, really the main argument the government is making in this case, is in fact that they think that these regulations apply to every everybody who has ever been convicted of a sex offense, even if they're no longer required. I mean, hear that. People who are no longer required to register, they believe would be subject to these SORNA regulations, to which I cry bullshit, and I will go down with the ship on this one. It's like, no, no, and heck no. It's no, 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 we're not going to do this. This is makes absolutely no sense. So I'm glad that we're litigating. I'm glad that we're a party to the case. Who knows what's going to happen here, except for the fact that I predict, and I'm doing this with a lot of certainty, that no matter how the trial court judge rules in this case on the motions for summary judgment, the decision will be appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Okay, so that's the next step up. You got the trial court level on the bottom. You got the Circuit Court of Appeals in the middle. And then top of this sandwich is a U.S. support. So again, I predict that this decision, whatever the trial court judge issues, will in fact be appealed to the Ninth Court of Appeals. That could be good. That could be bad. We don't know for sure. But I hope somewhere in there that the judge has a thicker spine, a stronger spine, and does in fact enlarge his preliminary injunction to include all states in the United States. A federal court judge has that authority. And if you all think about it, way back when, toward the end of the pandemic, there was a judge, and I think it was in the state of Florida, who basically issued an injunction and said people don't have to wear masks on airplanes anymore. And my understanding is when the judge issued that ruling, there were announcements made even on planes en route where the pilot said you don't have to wear a mask anymore, and a bunch of people took their mask off right on the flight. So judges are taking a risk. Judges in general do not like to grant injunctive relief, but sometimes they are brave enough to do that. Okay, we've got quite a few other topics to cover here that I will say that I'm going to segue now into California law only. For those of you who are here from other states, please know that you're free to listen in on what's going on. Maybe it's something that will help in your state. We just never know. So the next thing we're going to talk about really has to do with treatment. Registrants who are on parole in California have to undergo treatment for at least 1 year. That's what the state law says. The state law does not say how long. It just says a minimum of 1 year. And then after that, what's supposed to happen is the treatment provider and the parole officer are supposed to have a formal meeting with the registrant and make a decision whether or not additional treatment is required. It's possible, okay, especially if somebody violates parole, especially if, you know, we can think of a lot of possibilities here. So the problem is that CDCR, our Department of Corrections, had an illegal policy. Basically, CDCR was breaking the law because they had an unwritten underground policy that basically said that every registrant, the entire time they're on parole, must undergo treatment. Well, that violates state law. So when I filed that lawsuit, it was quite interesting because the Department of Corrections attorney called me up right away and basically said, oops, you caught us. What can we do to make this right? And so what they did to make it right was they issued new regulations last October. Let me put this in perspective for you. We have over 7,000 people in California who are both on the registry and on parole, over 7,000. So the new regulations are going to take a while to implement, because basically what it says is that every registrant on parole must have a containment meeting once a year. And during that containment meeting, a decision is supposed to be made about whether or not more treatment's required. And if the decision is yes, more treatment is required, then that decision is supposed to be put in writing. And guess what? A copy of that decision has to be given to the registrant. This is new, okay? And it's going to help us lawyers help you, because when you have it in writing and it doesn't make any sense, then we can in fact take court under habeas. So I'm waiting to see. I can't say patiently waiting. I'm waiting to see if in fact these regulations are going to be implemented as fairly. So far, the jury's out. I don't know. I don't see. I've gotten a lot of complaints about there have been no containment meetings, or there was one company that's basically saying, well, our program's 3 years long, so of course you have to do this for 3 years regardless. And I'm waiting. I'm waiting. I'm like a crouched tiger. I'm going to pound. I'm just waiting for the best case. I think I might have one. So anyway, let's see what happens. But again, if you're on parole and you're on the registry in California, they cannot require you to, as a blanket matter, they cannot require you to undergo treatment the entire time. So, yep, that was good. All we had to do was sue the bastards. All right, so let's talk about attempted offenses in California. This is the California Department of Justice making some bad decisions. They basically were assigning people who were convicted of an attempted offense, call it like the zipper situation, an attempted offense. They were assigning those people to the same tier under the tiered registry law as if you had completed the offense. And why I call it the zipper situation is, you know, somebody can basically unzip a zipper and say, I'm going to rape you. And the other person says, thanks, but no thanks. The person, you know, says, oh, well, okay, in that case, I'm going to go away. And there is no rape. But Department of Justice was doing is assigning them to basically the third tier because it was an attempted rape. So the court agreed with us that that was an improper tiering. And in fact, people now, we know, convicted of an attempted offense. And by the way, it doesn't have to be rape. It can be another offense. You're going to be not going to be put on three, not put on the same tier as you had to. Jeff or Ellie, you want to join in here?
Well, my experience so far is that the litigation that Janice was talking about that she brought forward successfully has been implemented. And I say that because I have a client who was a tier three for an attempted kidnapping with a misdemeanor registrable offense. And he had a tier three letter and then he mysteriously got a tier one letter. And so we're proceeding with termination efforts for him. And I think it's a monument to the use and abuse of power that DOJ has that authority and defaulted in the way that they did. And we're just lucky that Janice was on top of it and made that successful change. It's going to be big for lots of people. And a category of offense is getting away from the rape and kidnap saga. It would apply in this typical saga where the cops put an ad up that says, you know, looking for company, and then convince the person who responds to the ad that it's a minor. They normally charge those as attempts because there is no actual minor. It's a police officer who's the responding party. And I think those attempts look like they would all be tier one offenses under this settlement. So it's just really important. If you got a bad tier designation letter and you had an attempt, you should go back to the police department or sheriff's department where you're registered and ask for a new tier designation letter. If it comes out that they haven't made the change, then there's an appeal process that can be utilized to ask DOJ to reconsider and reclassify.
And that process involves attorney, by the way. I have been a little frustrated with the Department of Justice in their implementation of the case that they lost, this judge's decision. And they did tell me that they were going to mail letters. They refused to tell me when they were going to mail letters, how many letters were going to be sent, much less how many letters have been. So I don't like it when state agencies play these games. I'm very happy to hear what Jeff had to say, that at least one of his clients got a letter that basically said your tier has been reassigned. And by the way, I'm still held a grudge against the Department of Justice when it comes to any tier assignments, because in the very beginning, I believe that California DOJ should have sent letters to everyone saying this is your tier assignment. They have not done that, okay? And actually, when I questioned them as to why they did not do it, they literally told me, and I don't know whether to laugh or cry when I say this, but this is what they said, we can't afford it. So they're saying that the Department of Justice of the fifth largest economy in the world cannot afford to send out 100,000 letters. Give me a freaking break. So I almost volunteered to do it for them, but... but I didn't. So anyway, when they turn around for this issue about attempts, you know, I don't know how many hundreds, maybe a few thousand people that we're talking about. I guess they decided they have enough stamps to send out this many letters. But I still don't know that everybody who's affected is getting a letter, right? And that's what I'm really concerned about. So as far as I'm concerned, it's not over. And this is what Public Records Act requests are about. And so I just keep sending them Public Records Act requests, seeing what they've done or haven't done. Okay, let's move on to the tiered registry law. I mentioned at the beginning of this meeting that on March 25th, we have our annual lobby day in Sacramento. And that's on, again, March 25th. It's Sacramento. Please join us if you can. We need as many people as possible to persuade the legislature to change the tiered registry law. Okay. So the current language in the tiered registry law is a result of many political compromises. And so it doesn't, in some instances, it doesn't make sense. Here's the one that, number one, our called Exhibit A. Exhibit A is people convicted of possessing child pornography and being put on tier three. What? Right? So I don't believe that anybody belongs on tier three, but maybe if somebody does, it's somebody convicted of rape. It sure as heck should not be somebody who in fact was convicted of possessing child pornography, right? So because it's a non-contact, non-violent offense, but here we go. And by the way, putting people on tier three, those people on tier three, is a result of a political compromise. We know where the skeletons are. We know where the clock closets are, where the skeletons are, right? And yet it's got, things have to change. So we're going to go back to the legislature again on March 25th. And when we do that, we're going to ask them to make these changes. By the way, California's Sex Offender Management Board, CASOM, it's known by, CASOM has agreed with us that that change, several other change made. This is really important and should, in fact, strengthen our message that we have to deliver on March 25th, saying, look, it's not just us asking you for this, but also the Sex Offender Management Board that you created to make recommendations to you, and here they are recommending to you that these changes be made. By the way, we've got that in writing. It's not just something verbal. It's 5 pages long. It's got the rationale for each change in it. And so I'm optimistic in that we might make a change here. You need to know I'm an optimist by nature. So I say this every year. I'm optimistic. No, actually not last because it's an election. But anyway, I am optimistic this year. Come join us if you can on March 25th in Sacramento. Some of the other changes, I don't want to talk about that. Let's talk about the process itself right now. The first thing, folks, you need to know what your tier assignment. And again, I think DOJ should have sent letters to everybody. They didn't send letters to everybody. So you're going to have to go to the registration office, the place where you register, and you're going to have to ask them for a form that's in their computer. It's a government-only database, and we private attorneys do not have access to that government-only database. The form is called Form 8050, and the name of the form is Proof of Current Registration. And the thing is, when I file a petition, I don't know about Jeff or Ellie what your practice are, but I always include the Proof of Current Registration form. It's a form that DOJ came up with after the tiered registry law passed. It makes no sense to me that this form even exists, because if you think about it, why in the heck would you file a petition to get off the registry if you're not already registered? Anyway, I digress. But the fact is, that's what you have to do. Okay. And early on, I had some petitions rejected because I did not file the 8050 along with the petition. So maybe it just depends on the jurisdiction. I think, Jeff, you've said something different. Is that true?
I think the 8050 has to be attached to the petition, the CR 415, in order to get a court date and a court case number assigned. And so I've done that. In the original, when the system was first going into effect in 2021, I was filing the 12-page or 11-page renewal of registration, mm-hmm. and was told that was not compliant, but the 8050 was. So 8050 it is until changed otherwise.
Yeah. So, and again, it's in a government-only database. It really doesn't take them much time or effort to get it out of their system. Okay. So that's the first step. Find out what your tier assignment is. And if you're always tier one or you're tier two, you may very well want to contact an attorney, because we can help you determine if you're eligible. 10 years minimum if you're on tier one. By the way, I consider that the golden ticket from Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory, 10 years. And if not, if tier two, then you have to have spent 20 years on registration in general. Tier three, for most people, that means you're in the registry for lifetime. There's an exception. If it says tier three and dash tier level, I'm sorry, risk level, then that means you can petition after 20 years. But the general rule is tier one, at least 10 years, tier two, at least 20 years. By the way, this means time outside of custody. So if you, for example, have 5 years in the community and then you get convicted of a DUI and you go back to custody, the time you spend in custody for the DUI doesn't count. So, you know, there's variations on a theme, believe me. Also, things like if you're on parole or probation, you're not eligible yet. And the other thing is if you have pending criminal charges, you're not eligible. So an attorney can help guide you through these exceptions and everything to prepare and file the petition. The petition form itself is not that onerous, I don't think, but of course I've done 150 plus of them. It seems, oh, that's simple. But you might look at it and go, no, I don't want to do this. In that case, hire an attorney. Jeff does this, Ellie does this, I do this. You know, we can all do this for you if you don't want to do it yourself. Some people have PTSD and they're like, no way am I going to deal with another court document, much less go into a courtroom. So, the form gets prepared, the petition gets prepared and filed. Next thing is to serve it. And by the way, it's filed in the county where you currently live. So you might have been convicted in a different county in California and they get a copy of the petition, but that's not where you file it. You file it in the county where you currently live. Okay. So then it gets served, hopefully successfully. And then it goes, I call this period of, this cone of silence, because sometimes it's 4 months before you really hear anything. So, but what is happening supposedly during the 4 months, during the first 2 months, the law enforcement is going to decide whether or not not you're eligible. They're going to make a determination. Yes, this person's eligible. No, the person's not eligible. And then they share that information with the DA's office. They don't have to share it with us lawyers, by the way. Unfortunately, I think that's an unfortunate part of the law. Sometimes they do, even though they don't have to, but rarely. And the next step in the process is the DA then gets up to 60 days or 2 months to decide whether or not to object to your petition. The good news is that DAs are objecting to fewer and fewer petitions. This is really good news, folks. And it's because of two appellate court decisions that come from all places, Orange County, which is not known to be friendly to people in the registry. But these appellate courts spelled out very clearly that it's the DA's job to prove that you pose a current danger, okay, and not it's not the registrant's burden to prove that you do not pose a current danger. And maybe it sounds like wordsmithing, but let me tell you, it's huge. It's shifted the burden dramatically to the district attorney to prove that you do pose a current danger. And I'm paraphrasing, that's not what the law says specifically, but that's basically what's at issue here. I know before these two appellate court decisions came out, about 10% of my petitions were objected to by a district attorney. Now I think it's down to 5. Very few district attorneys object petitions. This is good news, folks. This is really good news, because if the DA does not object to your petition, guess what? The court must grant the petition. The court must terminate your requirement to register. Thank you, Dave. Wish I was there and could share a coffee with you. So anyway, so the cases are People versus Ty, People versus Franco. And again, in both of those cases, they said, hey, DAs, you have to prove this person poses a current danger. One reason that's specifically to me a delicious answers or decisions is that, guess what? The DA's office cannot make you take a psychological evaluation, cannot make you undergo any kind of counseling or any assessment. You can. And when my practice is, if one of my petitions does receive an objection, then in fact, I tell my client to go get a psychological evaluation done. And guess what? We don't have to share that evaluation with the DA's office if it should be a negative evaluation. Think about it. So if it's a negative evaluation, you just keep it to yourself. Okay. I haven't had one yet, by the way, but if there should be one, hypothetically speaking, you don't have to share it. And more importantly, you don't have, you know, the DA's office cannot make you go through an evaluation by somebody on their side. And here's a real life case, which was down in Los Angeles, and the DA down there wanted my client to undergo an evaluation through their county probation department and convinced the judge to issue an order of that. And thankfully, the probation department said, hell no, this person's not on probation. We are not going to assess this person. And by the way, of course, I made all these other legal arguments about the fact that there is no, a female, by the way, there's no valid, statistically valid, I don't know the right word, way to put that. But anyway, there's no assessment tool to use for a female registrant anyway. But that was, the better news, and that's more widely applicable here, is that basically the probation office refused to conduct an assessment because that person, in fact, was not on probation. So Jeff and Ellie, I bet you have some opinion about that.
Ellie, you go. You're muted.
Go ahead. You can go, Jeff.
You know, I don't have anything significantly different from what Janice just recited. I think we're kind of in the same boat.
Okay. Ellie?
What he said.
Okay. Ditto. Okay. So, folks, I mean, the tiered registry law is good, but it could be made so much better. That's why we're going back to the legislature to ask them to improve upon it. I mean, the original tiered registry law, to put it in perspective, would have made 90% of the people on the registry eligible to petition. 90%. The current tiered registry law is about half that. I'd say about 45, maybe 50% in general. Okay. And so and by the way, the original tiered registry law too allowed a group of people to automatically get off the registry and they wouldn't even have petition. Well, law enforcement did not want that to happen. So they came in with their guns blazing literally and said, hell no, you got to change this. So it was changed. Okay. And that's why we only have about 45% of the people who were eligible. Still, there, as I said earlier, there's so few people, relatively speaking, who've actually filed a petition. I'm not exactly sure why. I mean, Dave, you were at the meeting in Berkeley last Saturday. And when I asked this question, some people said, I'm afraid. I'm still afraid. They're still afraid doing this. Just if you can remember that most petitions do not get objected to by a district attorney. If there's no objection, the court has granted, okay, without a hearing. It's just the judge has to sign the piece of paper. So when there is a hearing, by the way, I've won every case except one. The case that I didn't win, I'll just explain briefly. And that had to do with the fact the person lived. He was on tier two. 22, and he had a 20-year registration requirement. Unfortunately, he lived 10 and a half years in another country. He lived in Mexico, where there was no registry. And so we did our best to represent that. Well, it wasn't like he was evading registration. He didn't have any failures to register. It's just the country of Mexico doesn't have a registry. So it was not possible for him to register. That wasn't a strong enough argument for the trial court judge. In fact, that petition was denied. But that's my only petition that's been denied that I haven't appealed. I lost one other one that was in Los Angeles County when one day a Superior Court judge forgot he was a judge that day. And he was a former deputy district attorney, and he thought he still was. So he said some things he shouldn't have said, all caught on transcript. And guess what? The appellate court agreed that he made the wrong decision. So that day, I was so proud of myself. I got to go back to his courtroom and do a victory lap and say, okay, judge, and I signed the court order granting the petition. Damn it. So anyway, yeah. Oh, that's cute. He thought he was still an LADA. You're right. Well, folks, I think that's about all that I have to talk about today. We're running out of time, too. I see 6 minutes on the clock here. If anybody has a burning question, please ask it now or comment. Ellie and Jeff, if you haven't already, please put your contact information in the chat room. I will do that one more time for myself. And folks, please know that all three of us are available for consultation Monday through Friday. I work 6 days a week, and then I go to DC. So I'll do my best to respond to you if you send something to me, and no matter what. So thank you, folks, for being here today. We very much appreciate you. We're here to support you and hope you stay safe and have a good life. Take care. Bye-bye.